So, hi everyone. Welcome to SANI. This is a podcast that celebrates African scientists, and a very special welcome to everyone for our first episode of the year. My name is Alex Nyako. I'm your host, and I am a senior research specialist at Avery Dennison. And today I'm hosting a podcast with
Selassie Wiafekoache, and I am a postdoc at the University of Maine. Today we are joined by Dr. Thomas Tego, a lecturer at the Department of Physiology at the University of Ghana and the Chief Operations Officer at GH Scientific. So, hello, Dr. Tego. Thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you for having me. Hello, Selassie. Hello, Alex. Great to be here to join you and have this conversation.
So we usually like to begin our conversation with our interviewees, really trying to go back and trying to understand more of their background, knowing more of their career journey. How did your past experiences, how did your upbringing, how did your schooling influence and shape your career path and field that you currently pursue?
Right, sure. So how far back do we want to go? Because like toddler years. It's I wouldn't say I had one of those stories that was, set in stone right from beginning. You occasionally have some people who knew very early on what they wanted in life, but I wasn't one of those. The earliest that I did want to be was to work in some shape or form with animals. I'm not sure. So if, like, I'd get home after school and I'm the one who'd be watching like National Geographic Channel and get really excited about that and want to be like David Attenborough sort of person. But I never really thought of a path that would lead to that. I would say where I am now probably started coming into being during my undergraduate years. I did my undergraduate at the University of Leicester in the UK, and the course that I took was in biological sciences, and it gave a very broad introduction to all fields of the biological sciences, right? Human, animal, plants, very broad intro. But as you moved on through the course, through the years, it narrowed down and it allowed each individual to sort of choose a niche that really worked out for them. And that's how I ended up in physiology. That's how I found my way into neuroscience. It's one of those. I would add that my interests were really in two particular areas, which one was in neuroscience. The other was in genetics. And at the heart of both of these things is the, it's at the heart of who we are as a human being, right? Your genetics end up defining you, and your brain, your nervous system is you. It's all that you are. So those were my two primary areas of interest. And I tell the story to students sometimes, and they ask me, "So, how did you choose between the two?" And I finally tell them that, well, my final grades in genetics, I got like a 59%, and in neuroscience, I got like a 74%. So, it's very easy to narrow down where I then decided to apply myself, having an interest, being good at it, and then, once I go into a PhD, there is this history, as they like to say.
So it's really shaped by the influence from the undergraduate studies. Could you shed some light on, was it the way a particular teacher directed the way they taught, or what was the really fundamental reason for that interest bubbling up?
I would say it was very general, like the subject area. I wouldn't narrow it down to any particular teacher in terms of the interest coming in at that point. But I could probably pick it up in terms of direct influence being from like my PhD supervisor, right? And that's been after undergrad, of course. And, you know, she really allowed me to grow into who I am now. I say it was my greatest learning experience in life ever, not just academically, but also, you know, as an individual, just personal growth. Because, you know, being committed to something for so long and doing that and having someone guide you through that process, challenge you through that process, point out your glaring flaws that you need to work on, through that process was very formative for me. But the undergrad years, you just study, you pursue your interest and you pursue what you're good at and see where it all leads.
That's also a very different story than what people might also be more usually expecting. And so we want to know more about your current research focus in the field of neuroscience in layman terms, so that our listeners can appreciate what neuroscience is all about. And then what are the main areas or problems that your research is trying to address?
Okay, all right, sure. So I think if you'd recollect, I said fundamentally what drew me to neuroscience is that, you know, the brain is at the heart of who we are, right? Now, the brain exhibits a very interesting property that is called plasticity or neuroplasticity, depending on, you know, we can just use plasticity. Now, all this is it embodies the ability of the brain to change, you know, whether it's its structure or its function based on experience. Okay, so things that we go through all the time can influence what the brain then becomes. And you know, it's easy for us to think about it, right? If you consider a child from birth who doesn't have any language capabilities, but as you expose them to language and, you know, society and so on, they then pick up whatever language they're exposed to and they become molded to whatever they experience. So that is plasticity and it's at the heart of who we are. So this is what I study, really. How the environment can influence this property of the brain to keep on changing. Because if the brain can change, then, you know, you think about everything we know about mental health, everything we know about experiences, about trauma, things like that. All of those things are subject to change and potentially the experiences people go through can change that. So there's a specific sort of tool that is used. It's called environmental enrichment. And this is one of the ways to then be able to alter the experiences that influence the plasticity. So the environmental enrichment basically puts all the experiences into four areas, like physical experience. So, you know, things that you do with the body and you're actually experiencing that aspect. Social experiences, which are, of course, your interactions with other people, preferably of the same species, but social interactions. Cognitive interactions, so things that stimulate your brain and challenge you to really think and use those brain cells. And lastly, sensory experiences, so sights, smells, tastes, and touch, and all of that. All those avenues, depending on how we modulate those experiences, forms this idea of environmental enrichment, and that environmental enrichment has the potential to play around with your brain's ability to change its structure and function in response to these experiences.
Yeah, thanks for that insight. So when you were talking, one question that came to mind was this argument of nature versus nurture. So does your research touch upon that, and what are your thoughts on that argument as well?
That's interesting. Thanks for that, because, you know, that's like genetics versus neuroscience, right? Where genetics is the nature and sort of like neuroscience being the nurture. So yeah, my interests have always been along these two. So I can share something about them, which is a bit of both. right? There's a element of significant elements of nature, which determines, you know, who we are and what we become, because it's imprinted in the genes. But then there's also the fact that you are a blank slate, and every experience then builds upon it. Even on the genetics side of things, you know, more and more we're getting evidence to suggest that the things that you go through in life have a way to modify how your genes are read. Okay. And there are a number of different studies that have let us know that it's not just about nature, but the extent of the nature also really matters. And these studies are usually like twin cohort studies, where for one reason or the other, you had twins at birth who have been separated and have ended up living very different lives, right? And then later on, these twins are brought together. And you can see that although genetically they are identical, based on what they have all been nurtured and how they have all been sort of like brought up and so on, these twins end up being different on a number of different markets and parameters. So a bit of both. Nature is great. It gives you it defines your starting point, but it doesn't necessarily define your end point.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's I like the way you said it. Nature defines your starting point, but it doesn't necessarily take you to the end point. And so we would like to switch just a little bit. We know that you are the Chief Operations Officer at GH Scientific. Can you tell us more about GH Scientific and what are your main objectives and some light on some of your major achievements?
Yeah, sure. So GH Scientific is a brainchild I started with my sister, actually. We co-founded it together. She plays the role of the chief executive and director, and I oversee operations. But we started this back in 2014, 2015, thereabouts, when I was returning to Ghana from the UK. I had just, you know, graduated with my PhD in hand, also quite excited. Just coming to Ghana, you know, to come and see what the landscape looks like, because I've been away for many years. And in looking at this, we realized that there wasn't a source of information to know what was happening scientifically in Ghana. There wasn't a place that one could get such ready-made information. So we had the idea to start that. What started out as just a news blog site and so on, developed into something much bigger, so that now GH Scientific is essentially building capacity in the science and tech spaces through a lot of public engagement and outreach activities. And we do this in the sense that we provide the spaces for, let's say, postdocs, young faculty, even postgrads, right, to volunteer on projects that we've designed. And in so doing, they gain experience, they learn lessons, they have the space to also give back to society. And these projects are designed to then build capacity in younger students. So we're talking about like experiential days for different sciences, or, you know, project-based learning activities, or even, you know, fairs and festivals and things like that. So we end up, you know, serving two different populations: the young students who need these experiences of science, engaging with science outside of the classroom, and then the more mature students and the young professionals who are looking for ways to give back to society and also, you know, develop themselves as well.
Yeah, that's a very worthwhile goal. Can you shed some light on some of your major milestones that you've achieved since the inception of GH Scientific?
Right, great. Yeah, sure. So our first major project was one funded by the Wellcome Trust, now the Wellcome. This was like a 15-month project where we brought together about 16 schools. We put them into about 8 teams, and they were set out with a task of, you know, identify a health challenge in your community that's sort of linked to the environment, and then design solutions to it. So that this project went on for over a year. And it was a great milestone because it was a great starting point to show that not only was there a need to sort of develop students in this way, but it was a very good proof of concept that we could do this and do it effectively. So that was a great starting point. Since then, one of the things we've managed to do consistently is every year do a neuroscience experiential day for students. Neuroscience, of course, because I'm biased in neuroscience. I might somewhere do some genetics experiential days, but we'll get there eventually. But yeah, you have like these neuroscience experience days where we bring together about 60 to 100 senior high school students for a day of neuroscience. They have a morning session where they engage with professionals in the neurosciences. So we're talking about psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, mm-hmm. neuropharmacologists, you know, neurosurgeons, mental health practitioners, you know, an array of people that all intersect with neuroscience. They have a morning to just engage in these conversations and find out more. Then they have an afternoon session where they do some practicals, right? Some hands-on activities, some of the staples in neuroscience, some behavioral tests, you know, try out some pipetting techniques, do some, you know, investigate your own nervous system. And then they do that really well. Like I said, I'm quite pleased that we've been able to do this on a yearly basis, every year since like 2017 or so. The two last landmarks I'd like to touch on, being just around COVID, we had our long-term project once again funded by the Wellcome. In these neuroscience days, they are funded by the International Brain Research Organization, IBRO. They've been very great supporters every year. But yeah, welcome 2019. We did this project called the Evolution of Science. And that was a very interesting one because it was new for the team doing something like this. What this was basically we sat down, we put scientists on the one hand and we put artists on the other hand. And then we set them a little task of saying, well, get together, collaborate and see how the artists can use their medium to tell pieces of the story of evolution of science in Ghana since independence. So, you know, charting over a 60-year period, right? Mm-hmm. You know, what pieces can you do that can touch on significant things that have happened within the scientific community in Ghana? And it was a great show in the artists, you know, various mediums, poets, musicians, sculptors, painters, you know, writers, all did something to be able to do, to create this exhibition. And then we sort of like launched the exhibition at the Museum of Science and Technology in Accra. And we had it up for about a month where people could come in and of course engage with the materials. We had like little handbooks to be able to tell the story. And even at the end of the exhibition, we've managed to, you know, donate pieces of it to certain places and a significant part of it still remains with the museum. So that was very great because we're able to show a sense of legacy, you know, recognize, you know, scientists that have done significant contributions. And, you know, the fact that it's even being donated to the museum and some of these pieces are still there means some longevity, right? Whenever people pass, they'll see it and it will lead to some conversations. So that's a very proud founder moment or co-founder moment for us. And all of that then led us to really start a membership, right? Mm-hmm. So that now we are really building a community around all the work that we do. So people come in, you engage with us, you become a part of this community, and it allows us to stay true to our vision of, you know, building capacity in people. Because you can't just do touch and go events, one-off events, and expect it to really be building capacity. So we have a community that we can then sort of like constantly work with, constantly develop, so that they too can go out and touch their individual spaces in their communities. And it's been phenomena, the sorts of changes we've seen in people that have stuck it out in the space, and then what they are currently doing. Yeah, it's been amazing.
Well, that's really amazing. I'm especially touched by the what you did in 2019 with the artists and scientists, because that's been one of my main interests as well, is just seeing that merge of science and art and how powerful that can be. But indeed, what I like is the twist with which you did when you are looking at the evolution of Ghana. And it's just really amazing that you were able to put all of this together. So that's really some major achievements. And with the community of people, I think in the end, that's one of the things too, right? Like having a community that we can just constantly, that are constantly sharing the vision that just started in a small, in two minds back in 2014.
It's quite right. I mean, you are spot on. That's such a great thing to do, and having such a community is so critical to keep things going.
I agree. So I'd like to go back to your research that you're doing. Can you share some of your memorable highlights and low moments as a lecturer, as a researcher, of your research? What has been some of those really high moments and then low?
Sure. So high moments are easier to say. Low moments take you to a low dark place. But yeah, right. High moments. One which has, you know, happened multiple times, which is, you know, that feeling which actually drives significantly what part of the research work I do. The moment where you make a discovery and you've been asking a certain research question, you run the tests and, you know, you have a hypothesis of some form, and the tests results come back, you analyze it, and it seems to support this hypothesis. I normally like to just pause and enjoy that moment briefly, because at that moment you can really sit in and enjoy the fact that you are the only one in the whole entire world who knows that this plus that equals this, right? It's new knowledge. You've just discovered some new knowledge that nobody else knows, and it's just, you know, something to really sit in and enjoy and appreciate. That's a high moment. Another high moment that I have, and this will seem a bit strange, is seeing the growth in my students. You know, students are coming, and initially we're talking about like research students here, where initially how they ask research questions is not the best. They don't really understand the need for controls, like, you know, controlling every potential variable and really thinking about it and making sure that you are only playing around with one variable, you know, how to consider like ways to analyze or even just approach to research design. Seeing students come in where they are a bit green, and then by the time they're leaving, you know, they are challenging your thoughts, right? They are pushing you, you know, you propose an idea and they are pushing back like, no, that doesn't work because of, you know, those are high moments, because it feels like another proud supervisor moment where you can see this. It shows that work has been put in and, you know, you've actually contributed to someone else's life. So that's great. Low moments. I need to pause and breathe, guys, because low moments are... During my training years, I was so used to being able to decide on an idea on, let's say, Monday, run it by my supervisor, let's say, Tuesday, put in an order for the new reagents you need, let's say Wednesday, and it comes in time so that by the following week you are ready to put that idea to the test. That was what I was used to. It works so beautifully. Now, low momentum in a space where sometimes the idea comes today, you put in an order tomorrow, and it may be 2 to 3 months before you get what you need. And by that time, you're wondering, wait, what was I going to do again? How does this, like, it just doesn't make sense anymore. You don't even, you know, it's having 2 to 3 months space between ideation and actually being able to test. It's horrible. It's probably the how I'd like to say it. But we're finding workarounds because we refuse to accept these low momentum or have to experience any more of them. Like, everything that can be done to avoid these lows. It's needed. On a slightly different type of low, which might be considered strange by anyone who hasn't done animal work. So a lot of my research, we use animal models, mice or rats, is losing an animal. It feels strange, but, you know, losing an animal that you've been working with for your research work, and then losing the animal, like the animal passing away unexpectedly, or maybe due to the procedure, the animal passing away. That ends up being a bit of a low moment. So we try to avoid those as much as possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I think those are things most of the researchers we spoke to have some level of appreciation of, especially with the funding issue. And I think it's something that everyone is trying to see the best ways and means of going around it, to be able to get the research published or to get it funded, to get more students in, so that you're able to do more things and explore more ideas. But thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So Tom, we'd like to end by asking, what advice would you leave with young aspiring scientists in Africa, folks who will be listening to this podcast and really gaining your experience and learning from your experience? What advice would you leave with them, even as they aspire to be scientists?
Right. So for young Africans, and actually maybe just young students, wherever you may find yourself, the advice I would give, which I think has helped me and I've seen it help others, is your network. You know, join a community, join a space that aligns with the vision that you have in mind. Have people around you who are also as bold as you may be, or as ambitious as you may be, or as bold as you want to be, or as ambitious as you want to be. Have people that resonates with where you want to go regarding research. And here's the reason why that is so important. Our environment plays a very significant role on who we are and who we become and who we even aspire to be. And if you are in a space where you are surrounded by mediocreness, you may settle for mediocreness. However, if you surround yourself with people who are really aiming for the stars, you know, have their moonshot ideas, are really looking for excellence, that is what you will end up also aiming for. So find a community, find a network of people that can keep you sharp and keep you challenged. It doesn't even need to be a huge network, right? Just people like that. So that regardless of what's the larger environment or the larger space you're in, regardless of what challenges may be pertinent in those spaces, because you have this small community that is aiming for better, seeking better, doing better, you will always attain better. And I think that's very important for young scientists in training or otherwise to bear in mind.
Yeah, that's powerful. It's like it seems like the central message is constantly being about having a community around you that will help you at every stage of your life. And I think that's a powerful message for our listeners. And so, Dr. Thomas, we thank you so much for today. Thank you for sharing your experience, telling us a little bit about neuroscience and also about GH Scientific. It's been a pleasure listening to you, and it's been very engaging. And so to our listeners, as usual, you can find us on Facebook as Sani, on Instagram as at Sani Podcast, and on YouTube as Sani Podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. And as usual, leave comments on today's episodes, on episodes that you might ask to bring your way. And see you at our next session.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All right. Thank you. All right. Bye.